right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again, and Dom, we have learned our lesson. We will not be doing any sort of dated banter as the intro to these podcasts anymore, but how are you doing at this completely unknown point in time?
I'm doing very well, and that is not tied to anything going on in the external world whatsoever, in part because the external world does not exist. It only manifests as an example of the concepts that are present in my own imagination, and that goes for you as well, my friend. You are only an idea that exists within my own being. But more importantly, we have learned, as you said, not to date this podcast and date it poorly by opining on the state of the of events in the world, because the last time we did that, we were saying that, you know, 2021 has been off to a fine start, and then we had a attempted insurrection, coup, whatever your favorite term is to apply to that, the very next day. So any attempt to actually date these episodes has gone very poorly so far this year. So we will remove any references to this year or anything else and just pretend that we exist solely in this vacuum of our own making.
I mean, just to quickly issue one slight fact correction there, Dom, it wasn't the very next day. It was literally January 6th at noon, we sat down to record a podcast and talked about how 2021 seemed to be off to a good start. And then when we finished the podcast, we returned to news of the insurrection, the coup, whatever, the terrorism that hopefully is over with. But we will see. Again, no need to...
Inauguration day tomorrow, so stay tuned on that front, I suppose.
But, and there we go with the immediate dating of the podcast. But Dom, we will certainly do our best going forward to have these kind of exist in the blank white void that John Oliver films his show in these days, Dom. I'm sure that's a reference you understand and appreciate a lot. So,
well, hey, he can stay in his own void. I don't want to share with him.
Okay. We have a couple of very exciting things to be getting into here today, Dom. I think first on the docket is one of the storylines from the history of Survivor that is certainly not one we are oblivious to, but given, potentially at least, its significance within just the scope of the franchise overall, I do wonder if this is something we haven't really talked enough about over the years. And Dom, let's begin today by talking a bit about Rob and Amber, the Romber alliance that we saw come together on TV in Survivor All-Stars and go on to define not only that season, but I would say define a lot more than just All-Stars in terms of the significance, again, of this story. I think plays a pretty big role, potentially in some unrecognized or at least under-discussed ways, as far as how the history of Survivor is going to play out from there. So let's get into this. And I want to begin by saying this is another topic that you brought up to my attention, and I'm very excited to be getting into a lot as things pertain to Rob and Amber today. But I'm curious up front, do you have a particular angle here that you're interested in, or is it just a lack of discussion historically that has you compelled to talk about it today?
So it was at the top of my mind because in my brief Amazing Race rewatch kick, which has now ended. I feel no more compulsion to go back and watch old seasons of The Amazing Race, although who knows if that will return with force sometime in the future. But I went back and rewatched season 7, which I think is generally regarded as one of the better seasons, but a big part of that is that this was Rob and Amber's first season on The Race together. And it's strange that watching them on The Amazing Race, of all things, is my starting point for this discussion, because that feels like so secondary or even tertiary as a part of their overall story arc, of their reality TV contribution. But I feel like that season, getting to see both of them interact in a context where they can just do their own thing, essentially, and they don't have to worry about what all of their tribe mates are thinking, and there aren't as many people competing for airtime, and they really do function as a unit, as Romba. It forces you to reckon with the question of, you know, why does their relationship work if it does? What do you make of the two of them as a pair? And so that just got me thinking about their place in the Survivor canon, which, you know, we have this split format here where we do one thing on reality TV, and then one thing that, for the most part, is completely unconnected to that. And eventually, if you are talking about reality TV, if you are talking about Survivor, you have to talk about Romba. I don't see how you escape doing that. Not just because, you know, eventually the topic of relationships comes up on these discussions. And really, I would say Rob and Amber seems like the most successful and enduring relationship in basically all of the reality TV that enters our field of vision, if you like, and has remained so after more than 15 years. So whenever you talk about the big picture of Survivor or the medium as a whole, you have to come back to the two of them eventually. And of course, I think they are just a fascinating pair to talk about in their own right as well.
So I was wondering to myself, there's got to be at least one or two, but like, I could not come up with any other showmance on Survivor that was like actively presented by the show as a good idea. It seems like most of the time a showmance comes up, it's in the context of, can you believe how stupid these people are being?
And even the ones which, as far as I know, are still going strong out there in real life, like Keith and Whitney, for example. I guess the fact that Whitney had a husband coming into the season was one of many reasons why they would not want to present that as a good idea, perhaps. But even the ones which are outside the context of Survivor are still going strong within just the text of the show when you're watching it. Often you wouldn't think that it was a good idea because you are given no reason to expect that. And it is weird how on Big Brother, which it's natural to have that read across between the two shows, showmances are such an expected part of Big Brother. And when you look at the numbers, they seem to be a pretty successful part of Big Brother as well. Like, people who have been in a showmance historically have tended to do pretty well. And I don't know how much of that is some kind of sampling bias. I think if you look at the average or the median showmance, that goes down in flames just as much as either of its individual components were always likely to. But we have seen lots of examples of successful players either be propelled to that success in part because of their showmance, or be able to just have that showmance on the side as a nice little addition to what's going on, and juggle that with the demands of the game pretty successfully. But even on that show, where showmances are baked into the premise, and you hear these, I would say, horror stories of casting now, where it's basically the entire focus is, okay, are you single? Are you willing to get in a showmance? And that's just the price of entry, almost, for getting on the show. Even with all of that in mind, on Big Brother, it's still very rarely presented as a good idea. It's more just, okay, well, this is what happens when you cast a bunch of horny young 20-somethings and lock them in a house for 3 months with nothing else to do. It's not presented as, oh, this is a good thing that we should be encouraging, almost. And then on Survivor, the conditions are much less conducive to any kind of romance flourishing, where, you know, physically, emotionally, you're under a lot of stress, and it doesn't seem like that's a good environment for that kind of relationship to flourish. And then even when it does, it often feels like there is some kind of spark that's there on the island, but it doesn't really amount to anything until after the show. So, you know, famous Ghost Island power couple, Jenna and Sebastian, who I think are still going strong, to my knowledge. Not only did you see basically nothing of either of them individually on the season, right, but the two of them as a unit of Genastian or Senna, whatever, that was not a thing. There was no suggestion that this was a good idea or even just an idea in the first place. So it is so rare that a showmance becomes just a thing at all in the context of Survivor, and then even more so that it goes on to define the season and then become one of the iconic storylines after all this time of the entire franchise.
Yeah, and it's wild to me that it happened on an all-star season of Survivor full of returning players who have played before, obviously, and are at least loosely familiar with how the math works on voting and have seen the enormous benefit of being part of a group of people that is just wholly unwilling to turn on each other. It seems like if any season were less likely to be dominated by a showmance, it would be one full of returning players, which is an element I had never really considered before. But it's amazing that Rob and Amber could go out there, be a pretty face-up kind of romantically involved power couple the whole time, and still more or less have people who are totally fine with that in the form of like Big Tom and Rupert and Jenna down the line, and like Alicia didn't seem to have much of an issue. Sue Hawk seemed eager to jump on board. I remember hearing years and years ago, Rob Cesternino talk about, like, oh, this is great. You know, we're on this small tribe, and Rob and Amber are obviously putting this huge target on their back, but he was really the only one who saw it that way.
In his words, Rob and Amber are going to do it. And sure enough, yeah. but if anything, I would almost expect it more in the context of a returning player season, or at least be less surprised by it, because, as I mentioned, on Survivor, showmances are not a thing in general. We don't have many good examples of cautionary tales that showmances can lead to. And I guess Rob Cesternino's own season was like the one exception to that in the early stages, where you had, was it Jenna and Alex, and you had Dave just being this horn dog constantly. And that season was very dominated by the hormones of, you know, 20-somethings on a tribe, on a season divided by gender. But for the most part, it's not like there's this Survivor graveyard full of failed showmances that you would think Rob and Amber would look on with some trepidation. No, it just hadn't really happened until then, in part because of the conditions that Survivor as a show puts you under. But also, I think, on a returning player season, you expect these people to already have some level of familiarity with each other, or at the very least, they've seen each other on TV before. So maybe you think, oh, hey, that guy looks cute or something. And then years later, you find yourself on the season with him, and there's already that kind of safety, that frame of reference with them to draw on. But that's an interesting thing to think about in Rob and Amber's case, because Rob and Amber were not the first relationship that Amber had been part of on that season, coming into things, where, you know, she had dated Ethan before then, and Ethan was he was playing the field somewhat. You know, he would go on to date Corinne, of all people. Really tough to imagine two different personalities based on their TV personas. Wait, than
Corinne Kaplan?
Wait, you're just learning this for the first time?
Yes.
Yes.
Wait, when was this? Because he was with Jenna for a decade or whatever, like when Corinne was relevant in the Survivor world.
I don't know if Corinne was ever really that relevant in the Survivor world, but long before this, I think, you know, in the mid-2000s or something, before Corinne had even been on the show. Yeah, yeah, it's a small world, apparently. But I hope I'm not just being fully bamboozled on that, by the way. I'm pretty sure this was a thing that seriously occurred. But yeah, Ethan got around. You know, he was the Survivor bike, if you will. there was Amber and Corinne, and obviously Jenna, he would go on to date for around a decade. I'm pretty sure there are other examples.
I have one other name that I have heard, but I will not be putting out there.
Why not?
I guess the fact that I have heard it would probably suggest that it is something that may be known by other people. I mean, whatever. I guess at this point, it doesn't really make that much of a difference. I had also heard that Ethan and Alicia, I believe, had some sort of history prior to this.
Yeah, I think I'd heard that as well. So you could cast a full All-Star season, a full, like, rival season by itself, just looking at Ethan's dating history in the early 2000s. But I don't know how exactly Amber fits into that that tapestry, but it was amusing on Winners of War watching Rob and Amber and then also Ethan just, you know, hanging out, shooting the shit. And there is that history there, which now in all of them in their 40s, and Rob and Amber have been happily married for 15 years, they can look back on that and laugh. But there was a clear rivalry bordering on animosity between Rob and Ethan in All Stars, and you saw the glee that Rob had about just being able to get Ethan out of the game.
Young Boston Rob was very eager to just cut down every single person around him in confessionals and make it clear, these guys are all idiots and I'm the only one who knows what's going on.
And I think that has always been somewhat a feature of his game. And you fast forward to Redemption Island, where you have a more mature and refined Rob who isn't calling people out in quite the same way. He's not as arrogant about it, but he's still reveling in the fact that he gets to hoodwink people and run circles around them. So I think that's just a core part of his personality. But it definitely came out in a very quintessentially Rob father way in All Stars, that's for sure.
Yeah, and to return to just the impact of Rob and Amber on particularly All Stars and the way that that story got told, and, you know, I think that is the formative season, of course, in cementing them as this kind of through line over the next decade and a half of Survivor history. How vital do you think it was that Rob and Amber ended up making it all the way to the finals together? Would it still have had the same kind of weight behind it if, like, Jenna Lewis had won the final immunity challenge or whatever?
Yeah, I guess you have the David Murphy counterfactual to explore there, where it's like, you know, you have to actually be on the show long enough for people to get invested in you before you can...
even if they just... what I'm getting at is, even if they come just 1% short of it being the two of them in the finals, they still go on to just do every single thing the same way and dominate the season, but somehow Jenna Lewis wins the final immunity challenge. Do you think the show still goes this route with the story?
I think that's a very astute question, and the answer is I don't think it has anywhere near the same impact. And so that becomes one of the ultimate butterfly effect moments, I think, where if Jenna Lewis just remains on that pole for a little bit longer, then, yeah, because if it's, let's say, Amber versus Rob, or I don't exactly know how the votes would have fallen with Jenna in the finals. You know, the idea of Jenna as the winner of Survivor All-Stars itself is just, like, hard to contemplate. But regardless, let's say it actually is. Let's say Jenna and Amber still wins the season. I don't know if Rob proposing as the third place, you know, final loser has anywhere close to the same emotional resonance that it does where the two of them make it to the finals together, so that's already a story for the ages by itself. And then I think that final tribal itself was a bonding experience for the two of them, where they came under so much heat from all of the jury members, basically. And they all had to make a choice, but the Rob voters didn't seem happy about voting for Rob, and they were all heaping vitriol on Amber, and vice versa. You know, aside from Shiann, who made it about herself, you know, in making the point that, you know, I am the only one who could understand Amber's transcendent level of gameplay on the season, and so I'm voting for the best player who I saw coming from a mile off. Other than that, all of the votes for Amber were basically, yeah, well, fuck you, but fuck Rob more, and if anything, we're doing this to spite Rob, and it's not about you, which is a theme we'll come back to a lot, I think, which is the whole Romba storyline or experience very rarely feels like it's about Amber to any meaningful degree. But Rob and Amber go through this trial by fire in that final tribal council, and then coming out of that, you know, Rob feels like he's been deprived, I will say, to pass up on the easy pun, because we're showing restraint in 2021. He's been deprived of the win that he thinks is his, and what better way to stick the middle finger up to all of those jury members, especially Lex, who spited you, than to get the girl, than to propose in front of thousands of people, live on national TV, at Madison Square Gardens, at the finale, when your wife-to-be, your new fiancé, is about to be crowned the winner, get the $1 million prize, and you can tell yourself that, hey, I didn't win the money, but I kind of did still win the money, first of all, but then also, I won the season, because I won my soulmate. Right, like that is such an incredible finish to the season and such an incredible fuck you by Rob that simply doesn't work, I think, if it's Rob cheering Amber on from the jury after voting for her as that final jury member, and then also trying to get the cherry on top and steal the spotlight, as I think it would have seemed, by doing the same thing again.
I think you are right, and I asked a great friend of the show, Casual Anna, my friend in real life who is a casual Survivor fan, what her favorite Rob and Amber moments were, because she, on some podcast from a couple years ago at this point, cited Rob and Amber together as her number one favorite Survivor player of all time. She was a big-time fan of that storyline, and when asked about her memories that stand out of Rob and Amber together on the show, the examples that she gave to me were the I Heart Rob shirt, him proposing on TV, and of course, Rob betraying that other guy for Amber. I'm talking about Lex, but I couldn't believe the detail that Casual Anna had on a season that was that long ago, especially considering A few days before this, I had been randomly talking to her about some recent Big Brother news. I think Nicole and Victor having a baby. And she said, wait, who won BB22 again? Like a few months ago at this point, couldn't remember the winner of BB22, but still remembers the I Heart Rob shirt and proposing on live TV. And I really strongly believe, like you said, Dom, that anything short of the two of them in the finals together, I think it is next to impossible that we would be looking at the same kind of Rob and Amber trajectory over the next decade and a half as far as Survivor is concerned. I certainly don't mean that they wouldn't have stayed together or whatever, because I definitely do believe in that whole side of things. But I also think it is very relevant along these lines to flag up the impact this may have had on the future of the show from the perspective of, now that Rob and Amber have had this miracle run and they're engaged and everyone's happy and they've collectively won the All-Star season, I am a pretty big believer, and maybe this is totally off base, but it has always seemed to me like Jeff Probst, and I'm using Jeff Probst as kind of a figurehead for the producers in general, although I do think it is specific to Probst in a major way, were so into the idea of this alpha bro dominating the game and getting the girl. And I think Boston Rob, by combining a very effective game of Survivor with changing his life and also Amber's life changing in a very positive way as a result of being on the show, and look at what a miracle Survivor has given to this couple who are now going to go on to be married for a decade and have four daughters. I, as we talked about during season 40, was blown away that they weren't force feeding that storyline into pretty much every single episode. I feel like this is essentially the number one thing the Survivor producers could have dreamed up around this point in the franchise.
So a few things to cover there briefly. So first of all, now that you bring it up, it is remarkable how sexless BB22 was as a season, right? Where after the show doubling down, tripling down, quadrupling down on the idea of showmances for so long in the Alison Grodner era, for this All-Star season to have basically none of that. I guess Memphis and Christmas, after the fact, were there to bring some holiday joy into all of our lives. But at the time, outside of, you know, Cody and Danny's weird, like, flirt, man's kind of, whatever that was, there was really no element of showmances on that season, which, if the season had anything else to commend it, that would have been one of the good things to appreciate about it. But as it was, you know, people are willing to just let all of that be in the past now. But also, kind of call someone out here. I don't know how casual you can really be after years, plural, of appearing on Survivor podcasts to talk about how casual you are. I feel like Anna is officially a fan now. Let's not take that title away from her. But it is notable, I think, how not just her answer to that, but I think most people's answer to that, if you ask them, what are your favorite Romba moments? What are your favorite parts of the Rob and Amber storyline? There's a lot of Rob and Amber together, and there's a lot of Boston Rob out there doing his thing, and virtually nothing about Amber, unless you are one of those people who is an Amber fan first and foremost, and then the Rob thing is either, you appreciate that, but it's secondary, or there are some people for whom they actually are not that high on Romba as a pair, but they do like Amber. So that's an interesting quirk to return to. But I do think you're right that Survivor, and especially Jeff, really loves the idea of not just a successful power couple doing their thing. And if that was every other season, it would maybe grow old quickly. But when it is so distinct in the grand scheme of things, then that's great. And then also the fact that those two people themselves seem to be so different, where you have this this alpha bro, and you have the girl from small town Pennsylvania who's kind of quiet, kind of meek. Personality wise, they seem totally at odds with each other, and yet they have this unlikely love story that succeeds in the most unlikely way. And Jeff, I haven't seen All Stars in its entirety in so many years now, but one thing that does stick with me is when they go on that car reward. Mm-hmm. And Jeff is like very awkwardly but enthusiastically third wheeling them, and they're playing along with him because there's this weird power differential where Jeff is at once the kind of a starstruck fan who just kind of wants to be in on the joke and hang out with the cool kids, but he is also the host of the show, and so he's wearing two different hats at the same time. But Boston Rob and Amber are both very politely like, hey Jeff, love you, great that you're here on the show, but can we have some alone time, just the two of us, please, if that's okay?
Sorry to jump in, but when Rob is driving the car and he like pulls into the place in some sort of flashy way and like does some kind of mini fishtail to give it like an impressive ending to the trip, Jeff is like, whoa, sweet moves, Mariano.
Friendship ended with Donaldson. Now Mariano is my new best friend. Yeah. But so Jeff has always been somewhat starstruck, wearing his heart on his sleeve as far as Rumba
wearing
are concerned.
His heart on his shirt like Amber.
well, quite. You know, Jeff is carrying Boston Rob's family on his back, literally. But like you said, that makes it so bizarre to me that in Winners at War, we don't get the Rob and Amber reunion storyline over on the Edge of Extinction. You would think that you would be slashing away at everything that you had to in order to fit that in there, you know? This is number one on the board with the bullet, and everything else, you know, the actual vote itself or all of the other ingredients that go into a typical Survivor episode, those will come second to the need to cram the Rob and Amber reunion, even if it's just for a minute or two, into that episode. And there was nothing. It's like you had to go online and watch a secret scene to even see their heartfelt, tearful reunion. And that was stunning to me. It's really a sign of, I think, how the show, even as it's priced into acknowledging its history by casting a North Star season, by casting all winners, it's so willing to ignore its history in favor of the hot new thing at any given time. And the role of the old schoolers on that season, it very much did feel like this was kind of like one of the old school Survivor reunions, actually, where Jeff would talk to all of the important players from the season, and then let's go and check in with the pre-jury members en masse, who in later years were crammed into the audience because they didn't even deserve a place on the stage. That kind of felt like the role that the old school players played in that season, where it's like, okay, well, we know basically that the winner's going to be someone who we've seen in the past few years, but also let's check in with the old fogies to make sure they're still alive, still doing well, don't need any help from our end. And it was almost like a reunion tour for a washed up band or comedy act or something, where you kind of go because out of a sense of obligation, but they clearly are past their prime, don't really have any new material, and are just a shadow of their former self.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly remember we were talking about that pretty regularly as we were covering season 40 in real time, is the surprise at the lack of Rob and Amber being explicitly woven into pretty much every single episode. And I would have thought potentially that having both of them on Edge of Extinction early might actually be the best way to draw it up, which is we don't need to have them really talking about the game or anything else going on. They get to just be here together enjoying their Survivor experience. Maybe not enjoying when they're out of the game, but they're at least reunited and can talk about everything Survivor has meant to them over the years. And I would have thought it was at least possible that was the dream kind of scenario for...
No, hold on. No, we need to hear some more about fire tokens. That's
yeah, seriously. And I really do wonder what went into not focusing more on that. And particularly, like, when the family visit rolled around, I thought for sure we were going to get a whole segment on the Marianos getting to see their kids and look at what Survivor has done for their personal life, and now they have these four amazing daughters and everything is perfect going forward. It shocked me the extent to which they ended up not focusing on that on season 40. But I do think prior to season 40, you know, as we were leading into season 40, we did plenty of preview podcasts laying out that we anticipated that being a big storyline. And I think the reason for that is it really seemed to me like Boston Rob in particular was someone who, after All-Stars and Heroes versus Villains, they really wanted to get a win on the board. And I do wonder if All-Stars had gone differently and Rob had somehow won, or if Heroes versus Villains had gone differently or whatever, he may have never needed to come back for season 22. And it had never crossed my mind before, but I honestly wonder if we never would have known what a Redemption Island was in terms of the twist itself and people getting just like a free second chance at the game once they're eliminated, if they had not had the need for Rob to keep coming back to get a win.
I also wonder how Heroes versus Villains might go differently if Rob is coming in as a winner and not just as the deserving winner by the standards of the fan base raised on Russell Hans, who in himself will go on to have this rivalry with Rob that they want to parlay into another season. And that's how we get Redemption Island in the first place. You know, if Rob was not the Russell Hans before Russell Hans, and instead he's the winner who's coming in, you're riding high on that momentum and probably even more in love with himself and his own game than he was previously, then maybe that season goes differently too. I don't know how exactly, but you know, that's an interesting thing where you tweak one dial and then everything else changes after that.
Yeah. And I also wanted to ask Dom what you thought about the two of them just being together on season 40 and Amber, I think, pretty openly talking about how, like, I'm really just here because Rob seemed to want me to be here. And it seems like a good thing potentially for our family if we can, you know, get a good result here. And by the point where we were at the re-entry challenges and so forth, Amber's just giving whatever fire token she has to Rob. I know a lot of people were not thrilled with that. It seemed like Amber was fine with it. And I actually think it does make sense for Amber. Like, I don't know that this is a situation anyone has ever really found themselves in before, but when it is a married couple playing on the same season of Survivor and one of them has just had the season before this revolve around a giant statue of their head and they have a recognizable brand and face and so forth, I think Amber would be totally correct to deduce that Boston Rob winning is much better for our family than me winning would be. Like, the visibility here that we are going to get and the possible like endorsements and things along those lines is not even comparable if I win compared to if he wins. And I know, again, that a lot of people did not love the degree to which she over the years has been willing to say, I don't really care what happens. I'll just do whatever Rob wants to do. I do, though, think that she has repeatedly voiced, this is something I'm fine with, and I actually think it makes a bunch of sense for me. But what do you think about that angle of it, Dom, of Amber being almost, like, eagerly subservient to Rob?
I know a great friend of the show, Sarah Channon, had a customarily spicy take that Rob actually should have, you know, they should have collectively heaped their advantages onto Amber, because were she to make it back in, she would have a better chance of actually converting that into a win. But I think you're right that had Rob won, the Romba legacy now takes on a new lease of life in a way which Amber, despite, you know, if she were to win again, she would become, you know, only the second two-time winner and one of their partnership. They would now have three wins to their name between them. Although maybe you would get the kind of thing that you had with Rob and Sandra in Island of the Idols, where Sandra, despite winning twice, you know, Rob is held up as like, oh, Rob's a winner. But there's always been that kind of imbalance there. But as you say, it's always been much more about Rob than about Amber. And so when I was watching their first season of The Amazing Race, I've gone back and forth a lot over the years on exactly what I want to see in terms of drama on reality TV and like how comfortable I am with it, how comfortable I should be. And sometimes it's fun to watch these strangers just having it out, or even people who are friends in real life really seeing the boundaries of that friendship tested. So to name drop Sequester for a second, the most recent episode of that and the few prior to have had some really great examples of that. And that's been compelling viewing, in part because you have these really close bonds, which you always assumed were there, but now those come under strain, maybe for the first time, and you see just what that does to them. And in the context of The Amazing Race, I find it easier to watch two strangers having some incredibly heated, incredibly really pointed, nasty fight than I do to watch just like the bickering couples, which have become a staple of The Amazing Race. And Robert and Amber's first season, there are a lot of bickering couples, let me tell you. And that was officially their role on the season. It was Ray and Dina and Ron and Kelly. Their role is bickering couple, basically. That is their entire personality. That is what their storyline is built around. So to see Rob and Amber be so functional and so just working so well together, not just by contrast with those other couples, but also in an absolute sense, it really does confirm to you and drive home that even though their relationship might not make sense on paper, and how much does any relationship make sense on paper, but despite having that contrast that Jeff so fell in love with between the brash Boston boy and the quiet rural Pennsylvania girl, they do click in a way that's important. But then there's always that nagging thought at the back of your mind that what if the thing that makes them click is that Amber just doesn't assert herself and Boston Rob gets to monopolize that entire aspect of the relationship, right? And there was what I thought was a quite revealing line in towards the end of the race where the stakes were clearly very high, that the $1 million was in sight now, and everyone left in the race was very stressed, where the one fight that they really have on the season, and it's a very mild fight by comparison compared to the 10 that the other couples are having every episode. Amber says, "I'll do whatever I can to make you happy. And after the race, you can make me happy." And you do really get the sense that this whole reality TV nonsense is what makes Rob happy. And Amber just, I guess, ended up on Survivor somehow. And then it took her to places that she literally and metaphorically that she never would have expected. And she's always just kind of been along for the ride. But it's really hard to tell if she actually enjoys it or is really emotionally invested in it a lot of the time. And so when I am sure when the two of them got the call to go on The Amazing Race, and this was back in 2004-2005, where they had just recently been engaged on national TV but had not actually tied the knot yet, so very early stages comparatively of the relationship, I can imagine Rob just like whooping with joy, like this is the kind of thing that he lives for, right? He's already cooking up these schemes that he's going to bamboozle people with on The Amazing Race. And Amber's just like, "Oh, that's nice, honey. Yeah, that'll be fun." And there's always been that undercurrent that stops me from fully getting on board. And if that genuinely is what Amber wants, is to, she does this because, oh yeah, it's kind of fun and it's a nice memory, but also I know Rob really likes it. In a way, that is healthy, right? Like it's recognizing that your partner really is invested in something and doing what you can to further that. The thing that holds me back is the asymmetry, I guess. I don't know if after the race, Rob does actually make Amber happy. And I guess you can infer that. You can read between the lines from the fact that they are still together. They have this entire brood and maybe we'll continue having kids until Amber finally bears a male heir. We'll see. But it seems like they are going strong. That they have no doubts, no qualms on that front. But I would like to know at some point after all of this media blitz and Romba saturation, what is it that Rob does that makes Amber happy? Like is if we had some documentary on their home life, does Amber have some hobby that she gets to go off and do and that Rob is helping her like make time for that by watching the kids for a bit? Or like what is her role in that relationship beyond dutiful wife and mother? Like that's a question I always come back to, and I don't know if that's problematic in some way, but that's always the question I have at the back of my mind even when I'm watching them just like put on a clinic on whatever show they're going on next.
So I agree with a lot of how you laid that out, I think, and I would say it is worth remembering, Amber was on season 2 of Survivor back when it was the literal biggest show in the country, and a lot of people that were on season two were openly on Survivor because they viewed it as a way to gain visibility in whatever their actual desired field was. And I think Amber would say, I went on Survivor largely because I was an aspiring model. And that helped, mm-hmm. you know, that went a long way in helping her modeling career, I would guess. And I have never really gotten the sense that I certainly don't mean to say that Amber doesn't care about Survivor. That is not what I'm saying at all. But it, to me, seemed like that was not her number one priority, certainly in Australia and Outback. And she's certainly there doing a very good job and trying hard in all of her seasons. But to me, I never got the same vibe that I get from Rob, which is I'm out here because I care deeply about playing this game super hard, and this is going to be my sole focus. I do think you are right, potentially, that Amber is a lot just more willing to let Rob have his way on Survivor, The Amazing Race, or whatever else. And I have no idea what kind of makeup is going on behind, you know, in off camera for reciprocation there. But I also don't think it is necessarily a bad combination here. As you have flagged up, this is a relationship that, while there are plenty of reasons to play up how much we are in love with each other for the TV cameras, I do not buy for one second that any of that is being faked. They are
clearly
still together in real life for like 15 years at this point, have a family and seem to be going totally strong. And whatever the dynamic is between the two of them, it is clearly working as far as I can tell. And I actually think, as I alluded to at the beginning of the show, this is something that we have not brought up enough over the 9 or so years that we've been doing this podcast, is just the sheer ridiculousness of these two people coming together on the all-star season of Survivor, dominating the game, ending up getting engaged on live TV at the reunion, and then staying seemingly happily married and having this big family, returning to the show every few years or so to let us check back in. It is utterly incredible that Survivor has this sort of thing going for it, that Jeff Probst has got to be beyond belief, even after all these years, that this is something that actually happened.
Yeah, and the way you know this is sincere is that Boston Rob is a consummate performer. He has a great poker face. He loves being able to like lie to people. It's a big element of his Survivor game. And he's always someone who is hamming it up for the cameras, and he knows how to cut a good soundbite. And I'm sure the editors love Boston Rob, not just out of their own personal fandom, but professionally. They know they can always get good stuff from him. And the Boston Rob that you saw back in 2004 on Survivor All-Stars was even more so than he is now, like very explicitly macho, you know, not someone who is going to be talking about his feelings live on national TV. And yet you saw him just like breaking down when Amber was swapped over to the other tribe, and just really just gushing about his feelings for her in a way which would have seemed so out of character in any other context for that Boston Rob. And this is a guy who could very easily hide that if he wanted to. You know, he's very good at doing that. You had Big Tom famously comparing him to a cat that had been like taken away from his mother and needed some time to get over it. And yeah, look, you could tell that you would not see that reaction unless Rob was genuinely feeling that and wanted you to see it, and felt like he just simply couldn't hide it because he was that overwhelmed. So you can tell that for as much as Amber loves Rob and is willing to, you know, wear that on her chest, so to speak, it is mutual. You know, Boston Rob feels the same way.
Oh, I mean, I think Boston Rob would be actively trying to avoid coming across like a softy crybabyitis, whatever, and couldn't help himself. And I think that goes a long way in selling the legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, Dom, I know we've certainly seen plenty of Robin in particular on the show over the years, and Amber has played a few times and certainly would pop up at the reunions on the seasons that she wasn't on, that he was on. I don't suspect that we are going to see either of them back on the show again, but Do you think that this is the end of the Mariano storyline on CBS? Or are they getting to the point where the girls are getting old enough that Jeff may be willing to stick around if we can get some more Mariano content coming soon?
I personally don't think Amber ever wants to be in front of a camera again. I'm honestly still shocked that they managed to drag her out there for Winners at War and got both of them together as well. So, I think that, like, that was her first sighting, I guess, in over a decade. And I'm shocked that they got that much. So, yeah, I would be even more surprised if we ever saw Amber back. For Boston Rob, you know, if there's some project that interests him, then maybe you could entice him out. But I think in Survivor terms, you know, he's had his fill. And unless there is another guaranteed good payday to the tune of whatever Island of the Idols was, then, you know, they'll be keeping his number in their Rolodex. But you did see this changing of the guard, so to speak, with Winners at War, where many of these iconic players declared that they were officially retired. And in some cases, it's like, well, you were kind of retired already. It's like, well, I don't need to hear that Danny Boatwright is retired, because I kind of assumed that was priced into my calculations the whole time. But yeah, I think that for the most part, you know, Rob is done with just the idea of going back on Survivor, but I would expect to see him on my screen, whatever that screen is, in some capacity again.
Yeah, I do wonder if the daughters are going to be encouraged to go play Survivor, because I'm guessing they will be asked if Survivor is still a thing, or if Rob and Amber are ready to move on to kind of a more normal life after.
Oh, we may see the franchise, if it's on its last legs by then, just being dragged into the year 2031 or whatever, just until the first Mariano girl turns 18 and gets to destruct their stuff on Survivor.
I mean, we could potentially have multiple of the Mariano daughters as, like, tribe captains. And incidentally, I believe it is the case that they've been in Florida for most of the daughters' lives, if not, like, literally the entire thing. One of the funniest things, and I obviously understand why it happens this way, but when Rob posts the videos of him and his girls at breakfast or whatever, and sometimes you can hear them talking, at least one of them, if not all of them, has, like, a very thick Boston accent as well, which is hysterical to me.
I think it would be incredible if, like, exactly two of them end up with a Boston accent and the others are just whatever you get in the Sun Belt or whatever.
And then the other two are from Pennsylvania. They're just talking about water the whole time. Blood versus water for the Mariano kids. All right. Any other Rob and Amber conclusions you want to draw at this point? Any other points you wanted to hit?
No, just to revel in the irony once again that for all of the other reality TV shows that are all in on showmances, or in some cases, like The Bachelor, explicitly about the concept of romance, Rob and Amber are still the, you know, they're still going strong, still the iconic reality TV power couple after so many years. I think it's great that Survivor, of all shows, gets to hold that title.
Oh, I think it is incredible that Survivor and Big Brother both seemingly accidentally are much, much better at bringing couples together that are going to last than The Bachelor is on purpose. I say on purpose. I think it has been almost 20 years since anyone with their eyes open has been able to understand that the purpose of The Bachelor is not bringing together happy couples, nor is that what the viewer is looking for. But yeah, I think Survivor and Big Brother have done incredible work, frankly. Like, I guess there have been just enough people who've played each show, and there is that kind of shared trauma element of, you know, not many people have this experience that we can so intimately relate to, but it is remarkable, just the success rate of Survivor and Big Brother marriages. I'm certainly not going to extend that to the success rate of the borderline infinite hookups that have taken place among Survivor and BB alumni and ended disastrously, but it seems like at least the happy marriages are coming a lot more frequently out of those camps inadvertently than they are out of pretty much any franchise on ABC. But Dom, I think that is going to wrap it up for us on the romber of it all this week, but we are not done just yet here. I do not want to throw away my shot to ask you a little bit about Hamilton. Now, certainly something I would guess the average listener has heard of, but not necessarily seen. Dom, you were big into the theater scene. How did Hamilton become such a big deal?
I don't know, is the answer to that. So you hear all of the hype about it going on years back, and it was a level of hype that I'd never really seen for another piece of media before. It was almost like a necessary qualification for polite society that not only had you seen Hamilton, which at the time would have involved, you know, trip to New York and hundreds of dollars thrown down on theater tickets, and you have to book it God knows how long in advance and so on. So I think that actually is part of it too, is that whenever anything seems exclusive, it generates this own mythology around itself automatically, and you want to be in on the joke, you want to be one of the cool kids that has access to it. And it's almost like seeing Hamilton is a cool kids thing for people who were never cool kids to begin with, right? Like, it's a very nerdy thing to have as your lodestar for your entire culture. But I think there was a level of self-generating and self-sustaining hype from very early on. And you also had these popular, influential figures just constantly evangelizing for Hamilton and presenting it as this, you know, the finest thing of our generation. And then when it just dropped on a mass release last year, and it was, you know, very accessible, it was very easy to watch, you had this whole new generation, if you like, being opened up to the wonders of Hamilton. And I'm sure for some of the old guard, the people who saw it in theaters after this incredibly laborious process years ago, that may have detracted from some of the charm. It's like, why are they letting all of this this riffraff in who didn't have to go to the lengths that we did? But that was drowned out by all of the new fans who were just loving Hamilton, seeing its praises, and then themselves drawing all these new people in to go and watch it.
So here's a actual thought that I just had moments ago. When you said people went to go see it in theaters, I was thinking, it's not a movie, Dom. People don't go see it in theaters. It's a play. They go see it in... Ah, okay. So I had certainly heard a ton about Hamilton for, I don't know the exact timetable, but many years at this point. And despite being someone who is actually, perhaps surprisingly, pretty well-versed in Broadway musicals over the years, I never got around to listening to, like, the soundtrack in its entirety. Every time I thought about it, I would see, like, the 2.5-hour runtime or whatever and just be terrified. And I would say that while Hamilton is maybe not the easy number one for me, it is certainly in the clear top two, and I would say in terms of sheer volume, it is number one, but in absolute hype, I would say, as far as Broadway musicals go, Hamilton in whatever it was, 2016, 17, 18, whenever I started hearing about Hamilton, is definitely one of the contenders. And then the other Broadway musical from earlier in my life that I felt like I could not hear people stop talking about and singing from was Rent in the late 90s and early 2000s. And I might honestly say that the Rent hype is more impressive to me, considering that was pre-social media, etc. But the Hamilton hype train, I definitely want to give a big time shout out to, because making any Broadway musical this much of a just staple within pop culture is an enormous undertaking. And were there not the Hamilton hype train, I don't know that I ever would have gotten around to caring enough to eventually sit and check all of this out in its entirety. And I will say that I don't know how any show could have lived up to the kind of expectations I had based around all of the hype that I had heard going in. And I think people would incorrectly deduce that, oh, we shouldn't have hyped it this much, it's not going to live up to the hype, when in fact, again, never would have watched it in the first place, and you were just totally free-rolling people who actually enjoy it when you hype it that hard. So big time shout out to the Hamilton hype train and all of what went into that. But I would say, again, Rent was the other big one that got just hype I could not avoid hearing about constantly. And then over the years, I would also say The Producers, which was not an original, it was the Broadway version of The Producers, was one that I would never stop hearing about being the hottest ticket in town. And Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane were the biggest celebrities on Broadway for a while. And then Wicked and Book of Mormon, I would say, were the other two when I was kind of thinking about musicals that have been brought to my attention over the years as someone not actively checking into musicals all that often. Those were the others that came to mind. But for me, certainly, Rent and Hamilton are the big two in terms of unavoidability. And then Hamilton in the social media age. I don't know that there's virtually anyone listening to this who has not both heard of Hamilton and could probably visually conjure an image of Lin-Manuel Miranda at this point. And that is insane, considering this is a Broadway musical.
Let's talk about the man himself for a second here, because
the Lin-Man himself?
I think it takes a truly astounding amount of moxie, which I also respect, to write what will become this incredibly critically acclaimed musical, this pop culture phenomenon, and insert yourself as the main character to almost make yourself the star of the show in a cast which is no slouch at all by Broadway standards or any other standards, really. And like, it's often said that he himself is the weakest part of his own performance, and I think that's true, but also that's kind of a weird flex in a way, right? Where like, you get to be not just the author, and you know, like, if you cast someone else as Hamilton, the name Lin-Manuel Miranda would still be spoken about in hushed tones by musicals enthusiasts or whatever. But to put yourself in that role and then come under criticism for the people who love basically everything else about your own musical, it's like, well, I could do without the Lin-Manuel Miranda of it all, but yeah, everything else is pretty solid. To do that anyway, I kind of admire the strength of that. It's like, yeah, okay, I gave you this amazing thing, and I will get to enjoy it myself in the front row. I will get to be on the front lines of that.
I feel like that's a pretty, I mean, Orson Welles in Citizen Kane is still, it's regarded as the greatest movie of all time.
It's not unprecedented by any means, but usually those people have some degree of their own dramatic chops, which I would say Lin-Manuel Miranda lacks, or at least lacks of the degree of the star-studded cast which he is able to assemble for the rest of Hamilton.
I mean, he is a very, very good singer. I certainly agree.
He's very good, but he's not to the caliber of the kind of people that you would want if you were writing Hamilton, is the point I'm getting at.
I 100% agree that it's almost making him look worse by making such a great show that he's able to surround himself with the best talent the world has to offer. And by comparison, that is not going to reflect favorably upon his performance. But, and I agree with you, and that was one of the takeaways I had upon watching it, which I did maybe 6, 7, 8, 9 months. It's hard to keep track of time these days, Dom. I watched it when it came out on Disney Plus and had not heard the soundtrack. I was totally sight unseen entering that, and one of my takeaways was, of course, Lin-Manuel Miranda is not on the same level as the rest of the cast for the most part, but that being said, it's because the rest of the cast are the literal best in the world at what they're doing, and Lin-Manuel Miranda, at least as far as I'm concerned, was a solid 8 out of 10. He wasn't distractingly bad.
No, but being an 8 stands out more when you're surrounded by 10.
Yes.
Right? Not that I would have any frame of reference to that at all, but I'm saying it's a nice problem to have, right?
Where for sure.
You can write yourself into this phenomenon knowing that you will be the worst of the bunch, but it's not the best of a bad bunch, it's the worst of a good bunch. And that's, if that's what people can say about you, go ahead. You know, I'm sure he's crying himself to sleep on his giant pile of money and Tony Awards.
It really is astounding that Lin-Manuel Miranda, a musical writer, has become an A-list celebrity, and not just Tony Awards, Dom. The man is, I think, very close to an EGOT, if he hasn't already pulled that off, the Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony combination. Let me ask you, though, setting aside the performance of Lin-Manuel Miranda, is the overall hype justified in your mind on Hamilton? When you first saw it, were you saying to yourself, oh, I totally understand why people are so into this? Or were you thinking, I am trying to figure out why people were so into this?
So going in, I was sure there was no way it could possibly meet my expectations, because those expectations had been raised through the roof so high by so many people. And in part, it was by people who were maybe obnoxious in general, but specifically very obnoxious about loving Hamilton so much. And so it's almost like I'm not expecting it to be this good. But if it is this good, it's this good by standards that maybe I don't share necessarily. Maybe it's not for me, even though I recognize its artistic merit. So I was skeptical, to say the least, going into it. But I actually really enjoyed it. I was I saw what all the hype was about. I didn't think it was like the greatest piece of pop culture the man had ever produced, like some people seem to. But I was like, yeah, okay, I can see why this this went viral and drew such a following.
So how common, as someone much better versed on like the modern Broadway scene than I am, is hip hop becoming in Broadway musicals?
Okay, let's go back a second. I am in no way more versed on the modern Broadway scene than you are. And to the extent that I am, it is the one aspect of pop culture at all that I would be more well versed in than you are. So I really have no much more to offer there than you do, I think. But I would imagine that Hamilton itself is driving that movement, if it exists, you know, not that it invented it necessarily, but, you know, the same way that Survivor cast a whole bunch of bargain basement Tonys after Cagayan, I'm sure there are a lot of wannabe Hamiltons out there trying to harness the same magic through the same medium.
I wish I knew slightly more obscure historical figures from the 1700s, but the only names I can come up with were like presidents that don't make good punchlines to that joke. But yeah, I agree with you. I am guessing that if it is not already becoming a staple on Broadway, Hamilton will single-handedly push it in that direction. And I will say, I was very quickly sold on the hip-hop element to this. And in particular, one, I don't know the specific tracks well enough, but I'm reluctant to call him my favorite rapper of all time, just because he unfortunately died after not being able to release too much material. But Big L, who I don't know how many people are super familiar with, probably a name that's going to ring some bells for people, but a very distinct kind of like rhyme scheme and cadence. And I thought Lin-Manuel Miranda in one of the early songs, like if not the first or second song, did an incredible job kind of recapturing that cadence, and that right away sold me on being willing to give this a serious chance. And then along the way, so many really well executed kind of allusions with an A to modern and older school hip hop, a lot of Nas references in there, some very clear Biggie references, some Kanye going on in there. This must exist already, but if it doesn't, I need someone to create like a Tumblr page or some sort of compilation of people on social media unknowingly citing Lin-Manuel Miranda as like the source of very famous rap lyrics from like the early 90s or whatever that get woven into Hamilton. That someone's got to already be doing that. But I think it is definitely going to be a continuing presence on Broadway, and I think with good reason. Rap lends itself really well to telling stories in entertaining and succinct ways.
Yeah, and I love the Tumblr drop there, as if you're trying to make yourself sound both old and also like a teenage girl at the same time.
Is Tumblr still around?
It's been through a rocky past few years for sure. A topic for another time, maybe, just the ins and outs of internet subcultures. But I think that Hamilton is an ambitious script, if you like, or an ambitious production, in the sense that it comes so close to going over the line and becoming kind of cringy, for lack of a better word, or really hamming it up but failing to strike the right note. And I know that Lin-Manuel Miranda is the biggest Aaron Sorkin fan that you will find out there. You could constantly find him tweeting feedback on the West Wing Weekly episodes and so on. And yeah, he is an all-in Aaron Sorkin stan. And Hamilton definitely bears the mark of someone who was raised at the feet of Aaron Sorkin. In its kind of like saccharine optimism and his overall vibe and a lot of the stuff that it has going on. And just like with a lot of Aaron Sorkin stuff, if it's done well, it can be great. And if it's done badly, it is, oh my God, that is terrible. So yeah, the contrast between The West Wing at its best and, well, not just The West Wing at its worst, but The Newsroom at any point, it is a good example of that. And so you can imagine a version of Hamilton which veered slightly in a different direction and flopped terribly because the whole vibe would just be off, and it would still, I'm sure, go down very well with the people who like what I would consider the schlock of Aaron Sorkin, but it wouldn't be this mass market sensation the way that it is now, whereas he, whether by accident or through very careful restraint, has just about struck the right note to make this go down well even with the people who would normally be very skeptical of the worst excesses of the Sorkin brand, if you like.
Okay. And another thing that I wanted to ask about is how to describe this, the like representation angle. I don't know what the backstory here is on this, but I certainly noticed that we are dealing with 18th century American Revolution times, and everyone in the cast playing George Washington and Alexander Hamilton and so forth, other than Jonathan Groff, is not white.
Yeah, well, I think there are a few angles you can take on this. So if you are trying to make a completely historically faithful representation, then obviously that's going to stand out and be jarring. And so when the James Bond movies were being recast with non-white leads and so on, part of me thought, well, firstly, why can't we just create new stories instead of having to make derivative ones and then presenting that as a victory for representation? But then also, part of the James Bond character only functions in the first place because he exists in this specific like historical milieu where he was this like very posh, charming, well-spoken white guy, and that opened every door for him, and had every woman he met swooning over him, and that is part of the fantasy. It is part of the whole aesthetic of it, and so you can make a stronger statement by reacting against that, but it also means that the whole thing is going to have it is going to make you suspend your disbelief in different ways. Whereas for this, I kind of feel like it brings a Bridgerton vibe to it, if you've been watching that, where like, okay, yes, Regency England does not have this level of A, hot people, first of all, but B, or a racially diverse cast of hot people. But who cares, right? It's fun, and being able to mess around with those like central assumptions about hierarchy is part of what makes the world building as good as it is. And so for Hamilton, being able to showcase this this diverse cast and use that as an entry point to the immigrants, we get the job done line that you can hear the raucous cheers on the studio recording or whatever, that is part of the vision, I think, for Hamilton. That is part of the point. It's not meant to be some educational device for teaching people about early American treasury secretaries,
right. No, and I'm certain that it is very deliberate, but I actually, unless I may just be interpreting what you said backwards, but I would have thought that like the James Bond point of it's difficult for Idris Elba to, if it were set in the 60s or whatever, be going around uninterrupted by people versus a Sean Connery. But James Bond doesn't continue being set in the 60s and 70s and so forth. They've updated it and it's modern times. When this is a project set in the 18th century with very specific historical figures at a very specific time, I would have thought that that may have been more of a potential issue along those lines. But having seen this played out, and it's not like I went in thinking, oh my God, this is going to be such an issue. I certainly was not of that opinion. But even more so after actually seeing it play out, I think this much potentially even more so than the hip hop infusion on Broadway could be, not just on Broadway, but in just mainstream media, a major difference maker. Like watching this cast play George Washington and all of these historical figures about whom I have no question if their actual real life ethnicity and so forth. And I could see Hamilton 20 years from now being routinely cited as the project that really broke the floodgates wide open in terms of people from all sorts of backgrounds playing all sorts of roles.
Yeah, and I'm sure you can find corners of like leftist Twitter fulminating about the liberal message that Hamilton has to send about slavery or whitewashing certain aspects of American history or whatever. But I mean, there are discussions to be had there for sure. But I think that, you know, this is where the Sorkinite vibe of the show maybe comes back into view again. I call it the show, not a show, whatever, doesn't matter. But honestly, that's how I think a lot of people will have experienced it. It's as like a home movie almost, where I did try years ago listening to the soundtrack, or I found some very grainy recording that someone had snuck out of one of the Broadway productions, and obviously does not have nearly the same majesty when you're trying to, you're like squinting at the screen trying to piece together who these people actually are versus in full like Technicolor glory what just sitting back and letting it unfold. But I do wonder how, you know, if you are someone who watched Hamilton from home and loved what you saw, if when we are legally allowed to go back into theaters again, if let's say Hamilton was back with the same level of exclusivity, like you had to pay the same prices and you had to wait the same length of time as you did in 2015, 2016, I wonder how many people that would be worth it for, like how new the experience is when you're getting to watch it in that new setting.
Yeah, I would guess, honestly, that the release on Disney Plus was kind of a double-edged sword. I would guess overwhelmingly good in general, where the exposure is way, infinitely beyond anything you could hope for on Broadway in New York. But, or, you know, however many touring shows you want to do, there's no way you're going to match the viewership of Disney Plus there. But at the same time, I do wonder if now Hamilton, the live show, has become less of an exciting event for people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that is a very worthwhile trade-off if you are certainly Lin-Manuel himself, or just the larger people with a vested interest in Hamilton. I think there's virtually no discussion to even be had that having it go up on Disney Plus and become this globally accessible thing is one of the best case scenarios for how all of that could end up playing out. Do you know if Lin-Manuel, is he still writing plays, or is he doing more like Hollywood stuff?
I actually don't know that myself. I'm sure he has a busy calendar these days, to put it mildly. Let's scan the Wikipedia page, which really anyone listening could do in lieu of listening to us. So I don't know if we should make this a constant fixture of the of the episode.
One of these weeks we should come in and just be like, just give the listeners topics to go home and study themselves and just be in and out in 40 seconds.
This is your homework. Your job now is to teach us after we've done so much to educate all of you. Now it's your turn to repay the favor.
Yeah. One other follow-up question while you potentially try to pull up Lin-Manuel's projects currently in the works. Dom, how did you feel like the British were represented here in this project?
Oh, I loved it. The incredibly camp King George just flouncily renouncing the entire project. Loved it. My favorite part of the whole thing.
Yeah, I feel like that is one of the more common takeaways I've had, and I don't know how much of that is because of Jonathan Groff himself, who is one of the iconic kind of performers of his generation who just completely knocks that role out of the park. But I will say that, yeah, after watching the entire show once through, the number one song that I found myself returning to, like, on YouTube is that one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I do want to say, extremely good stuff overall. I don't know that I've been clear on this. I did definitely enjoy the musical as a whole and very much understand what all of the hype is about, not only just in terms of sheer quality of the product, but also just the extent to which it stands out compared to pretty much any other Broadway musical I've seen. I think Hamilton has pretty much everything you could have hoped for going for it in terms of being a Broadway musical coming onto the scene in whatever it was, 2014, 15. Still no idea. Probably could have looked that one up prior to coming on the recording here, Dom. But yeah, I definitely, on the whole, want to be clear, very much enjoyed my time with Hamilton. Would be willing to go see a stage version of it, although not in the situation where I have to pay an insane amount of money and wait forever for tickets or so forth. I think I would honestly rather go see Hamilton done by a less professional group of people than a big fancy production.
Oh, I'm sure there are going to be like amateur high school productions of Hamilton for many decades to come.
Yes. Well, Dom, anything else for you on Hamilton or anything else on musicals? Let me ask you, maybe someday we can come in and do just a whole musicals ranking podcast, but what comes to mind for you as your favorite musical?
I loved Chicago, Book of Mormon. I don't have any, my tastes are very casual, very, you know, I'm not going to have any obscure deep cuts to throw in here, but I like the ones that you'd expect. Loved seeing Wicked. Had heard all of the hype about that, had basically been forced into seeing it at gunpoint, but loved it. I was understood what all the hype is about there. We could get a Robin Amber musical someday. We're trying to tie the two themes together here. How do you feel about that?
Did they ever play in South Pacific? Can we work some sort of... I don't think they did. But actually, Rob wasn't too far away from season 23, although I guess shot in an entirely different location probably. So we'll work on that. We will definitely get back to you with the Romber musical. But Dom, I'm going to say, just for the official record, without putting a ton of thought into it, if I could only listen to one musical soundtrack for the rest of my life, I think give me West Side Story. I'm an OG. I'm a purist. But I think, Dom, for the time being, that is going to wrap us up here on the Hamilton and just Broadway at large kind of discussion for the day. Anything further from you on any topics that you want to get to before we get out of here?
I'm good. I had a ton of fun talking about both of these. And yeah, we really put a pep in my step.
Yeah, very good stuff here today, Dom. I think that is finally going to wrap us up here, and we will be back next Wednesday here on the main feed. And until then, we will talk soon. Take care, everybody.